This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Meat has gotten a very bad rep because when animals are mismanaged, as they are in most cases, there is destruction to the environment. There is harm that is caused. But the flip side of that coin is that when animals are managed in a way that mimics or emulates nature, the result is restorative.
To meat or not to meat? That is the question. Recent innovations in lab-grown meats seem to be making non-meat burgers and tacos a tastier option than they've ever been. But are these products too good to be true? And are non-meat alternatives always more ecologically responsible than actual meat? This week's guests on Sea Change Radio have some thoughts on the matter. We speak with the co-founders of Soil for Climate, Seth Itzkan, and Carl Tiedemann, about the mission of their organization. They lay out the benefits of regenerative farming and grazing practices, as well as a lifestyle that includes eating plenty of meat. They also explain why they hope companies like Impossible Foods ultimately fulfill the promise in their name and cease to be possible. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Seth Itzkan and Carl Tiedemann. They are the co-founders and co-directors of Soil for Climate. Seth, Carl, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be here.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So either one of you, why don't you first kind of tell our listeners who aren't familiar with your organization what the mission of Soil for Climate is.
Sure. So our group is called Soil for Climate, and as the name says, we're advocating for soil as a climate solution, even more specifically, soil restoration as a climate solution. And it turns out that soil is the biggest sink, if you will, or reservoir for carbon. And when we restore soil, we help mitigate, if not reverse, global warming. Carl, do you want to add to that?
Sure. We do this through our Facebook group that has over 11,000 members from more than 100 countries around the world. We're closely affiliated with Tufts University in Boston, where we've co-authored several policy briefs to help get these ideas out into the academic community. And we support farmers and ranchers throughout the world who are adopting different practices to improve the health of their soil, and in so doing, grow more nutritious food, become more productive, as well as helping to increase drought resilience and prevent flooding and so on.
So why is soil a hopeful message in your estimation?
Because when you restore soil, you get all these other ancillary benefits as well. So in addition to drawing down atmospheric carbon and helping to mitigate, if not reverse, global warming, you also retain enormous amounts of water. So you mitigate flood damage, but because there's more water, you also mitigate drought damage. So you are making the ecosystem more resilient to the impacts of global warming, even as you're helping to actually reduce global warming. Additionally, you're producing better, healthier food. So there are all these academics that we're now experiencing anyway that haven't necessarily been associated with global warming, and maybe they aren't necessarily associated with global warming, but they are associated with poor food quality. And so this methodology also improves food quality, and it moves us off of the addiction, if you will, to artificial fertilizers and pesticides and the whole sort of chemical paradigm of agriculture. And what's interesting is that a lot of the best practitioners are sort of middle America farmers and ranchers who are basically politically conservative. So, you know, they might be voting on, you know, the right side of the aisle. Nonetheless, their practices on the land are completely conducive with helping to mitigate global warming. So we're hopeful about it because of the physics and biology of it in terms of its impact on climate and water and those types of things. But also politically, it's kind of an issue that our otherwise polarized, you know, society can get around on. You know, very few people are against improving soil.
So, Carl, maybe you can kind of give us a glimpse into what it takes for a farmer to kind of change their mindset and embrace a more regenerative agricultural practice.
Sure. I think in many instances, it's farmers learning from each other. In this case, farmers are really at the forefront of the revolution. And I would say science is, in a way, trying to catch up to what many of the farmers have been able to achieve. Because frankly, what we are seeing on many farms is not widely recognized or accepted as even being possible. So farmers, in some cases, they do it in stepwise fashion. So they might begin by doing no-till, which is to say not plowing their land anymore. The idea being to leave the soil as undisturbed as possible so that the bacteria and the fungi can operate most effectively. Many farmers then will begin using cover crops, which is to say keeping their field, something growing on their fields instead of leaving the fields bare and fallow, which used to be thought was a beneficial practice. There's also a large move now toward using diversified cover crops, which is to say having as many different types of plants as possible. There's been a revolution in soil biology showing that the way carbon gets into the soil, or most of the carbon gets into the soil, is through root exudates, which is to say plants make sugars and then release these sugars. You can think in terms of maple syrup or maple sap flowing into the ground, and that's what feeds the soil life. And every plant, it turns out, makes its own specific blend of this sap that's being released. So the more different types of plants you have, the more diverse microbial communities are being fed, and you can begin to see different synergistic properties emerge from the soil biology, which help to contribute greatly to plant health, to resistance to disease and pests and so forth.
So Seth, you mentioned how there's a chance that regenerative agriculture and restorative grazing practices can not just mitigate global warming, but kind of reduce the effects of climate change. Maybe you can kind of give us a snapshot of how that might actually work.
Right. So you see, there's two things going on. One is the actual carbon concentrations in the atmosphere, the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. I mean, the organization 350.org, which is the world's leading, you know, climate advocacy organization, that number 350 refers to parts of CO2 in the atmosphere, right? 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're already over 400. This is considered a very bad thing. So that number literally needs to come down, okay? And that has to do with forcing, you know, the whole greenhouse forcing, warming the earth. But there are other factors as well. And there's literally carbon cycles and water cycles on the ground, regardless of what the CO2 level is. So for example, if you're standing in a parking lot, you're hot, right? That parking lot is hot in the summer, whereas in the woods it could be cooler. The CO2 is still the same.
Right.
But there are these localized effects. It's called localized cooling or localized warming. And there's the evapotranspiration cooling effect when plants, you know, perspire. That creates a cooling. So having plants, having better soil biology and better ground cover creates a cooling, I have sort of quote unquote, a regional cooling on its own, which also impacts the climate, regardless of whatever the CO2 level is. But as you're restoring soil, you are also bringing the CO2 level down. So you're simultaneously reducing the warming effect from CO2, and you're reducing the warming effect from ground radiative forces. So you have those two things working for you.
As Seth mentioned, the restoration of the water cycle is a key part of this. Throughout the world, land areas are drying out, rivers are drying up, lakes are shrinking, and the question is, well, what can be done? And the typical solution is to build the deeper well, more salination, desalination plants, pipelines, and trucks to bring in water and so forth. And by going the natural route, instead by healing land so that it captures more water, that allows aquifers to be replenished, for dried up rivers to come back to year-round flow. So it's really about restoring the natural sources and supplies of water as well.
And also, Alex, I want to pick up on the question before about how to help influence or encourage the producers to do the right thing. I mean, ultimately for them, they're not trying to be philanthropists. You know, it has to be the bottom line. You know, they at the end of the day need to be making more money. And what we're trying to get the systems, including the economic systems and the taxes and the rewards and the markets, to benefit producers who are doing the right thing. And so consumers play a big role in this. You know, you need to ask for organic fruits and vegetables and grass-fed, grass-finished meats. And then, you know, the Savory Institute has a new program now called Land to Market. And then they have a new type of verification called ecological outcome verification. So they're actually verifying the outcomes on the land. And that's a significant step from just organic, which I think we all know has been sort of co-opted, unfortunately, which is about, well, are you spraying chemicals or not? What the Savory Institute is looking at, their EOV program, ecological outcome verification, is they're actually verifying that the land's getting better. You know, so better soil carbon, better water retention.
Look at all the cows in the slaughterhouse yard. Gotta hit them in the head, gotta hit them real hard. First you gotta clean it, then the butcher cuts it up, throws it on a scale, throws an eyeball in a cup. Saw a big brain of steer standing right over there. So I rustled up a fire, cooked a medium rare. Barbecued his brisket and roasted his rump. Fed my dogs with a brain of steer's hump. Eat steak, eat a big old steer. Eat steak, do we have one here? Eat beef, eat beef. It's a mighty good food. It's a great A meal when I'm in the mood.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Seth Itzkan and Carl Tiedemann. They are the co-founders of Soil for Climate. So Seth, you had mentioned earlier how consumers need to be mindful about what they buy and ask for organic fruits and vegetables and grass-fed meat. I'm sure a lot of environmentalists, their radar went up when they heard that, because there's a movement afoot to stop eating meat. But you don't look at the solutions as being meat-free, do you?
Oh, absolutely not. Meat and grazing are essential parts of restoring soil to mitigate, if not reverse, global warming.
Why don't you explain about that? Because a lot of people assume that in any Green New Deal, that there's going to be some sweeping legislation from the libs who want to steal your hamburgers.
No, not at all. In fact, it'll probably be the opposite. And no one's more liberal than we are. What it comes down to is soil. It really comes down to soil and, like, where's the carbon, you know? And so there's nothing about a veggie burger that's pulling carbon out of the air. Nothing. Veggie burgers, Impossible Burger, they're based entirely on GMO, monocrop soy, high-tech operations, glyphosate sprayed. The whole thing is a facade to make money on intellectual property. And it's all about putting soybean proteins inside of yeast bacteria to grow a heme molecule so it tastes like blood. This is a completely useless technology, and they're just trying to figure out a way to make $1 billion off of it. So they're convincing people that this is an alternative to meat. Actually, it's a boondoggle. And we're going to do everything we can to stand against that and to let people know that the proof is in the soil. You know, are you restoring soil or aren't you? And regenerative grazing restores soil.
Meat has gotten a very bad rap because when animals are mismanaged, as they are in most cases, there is destruction to the environment, there is harm that is caused. But the flip side of that coin is that when animals are managed in a way that mimics or emulates nature, the result is restorative. And we need look no further than the ecological history of North America, where an estimated 65 million bison maintained the health of the land and essentially grew the deepest, darkest, richest topsoil that was the envy of the world when the settlers or the Europeans first arrived on the continent, you know, some several hundred years ago. So the bison, and in because there are no longer bison in their stead, domestic livestock, cows in particular, when they're managed properly, which is to say kept bunched together in herds, moved frequently to eliminate any possibility of overgrazing, allowing enough time for the grasses to grow back before the animals return to the original grazing spot. By adopting this practice, cows become a very powerful ecological restoration force, restoring land not just for themselves and for us and sequestering carbon, but restoring land so that all wildlife can thrive. So it's not well known, but there are an estimated 5 billion hectares, roughly five times the size of the land area of the U.S., throughout the world, that used to be grasslands and savannas, grasslands with trees, that are now very heavily degraded to the point that they support very little wildlife. And the only way to restore this land is to bring back the beneficial ruminant impact that this land co-evolved with. There's a common misconception: if you just leave land alone, it'll inherently get better. That's true in places like New England because of the rainfall that we get throughout the year. But in large parts of the world, land that does not have the proper ruminant impact just continues to degrade. So we've got to get the cows back on land all over the world.
And where do you guys stand on lab-grown meat? Is it something that can be complementary with more effective grazing of animals, or do you see it being an alternative?
Well, that's what I was just commenting about on my little rant a second ago. It's a boondoggle. It's what we call an IP play, intellectual property play. At this point now, they're actively going against regenerative grazing.
When you say they, who are you talking about?
Impossible Foods. Impossible Foods is the company that makes Impossible Burger, and their backers, you know, the Bill Gates. Look, this whole thing, it's a high-tech, high-finance, intellectual property, boondoggle to basically concentrate power around food, seeds, Monsanto, keep animals off the land. They basically would be happy to get rid of animals altogether and soil for that matter. This is a nightmare fantasy, and there's nothing hip about it. I don't want any of your readers to think, oh, it's cool to have an Impossible Burger. It's not. It's the least cool thing you can do. It's the least hip thing you can do for the environment. You want to do something cool, go down to your local market and demand a grass-fed, grass-finished meats. Demand that they carry meats that have ecological outcome verification labels on them. Be active that way.
And even the raw materials for the cultured meat products still come from an industrial agricultural paradigm. And I've just, in fact, learned recently that when you grow meat in a test tube or in a vat or in a bioreactor, it has to be grown in an antibiotic-rich media because you don't want to have any other foreign bacteria interfering with the process. So for me, eating a meat or a fake meat product that's been grown in an antibiotic wash or bath just has zero appeal.
Yeah, and just to be clear, they aren't growing meat. That's just another Madison Ave made up meme. What they're doing is they literally have genetically engineered yeast to produce a heme molecule, okay? And that's the molecule that's in blood, that it's basically iron, and it gives it this appearance of blood. So they're literally genetically modifying a bacteria to create a molecule similar to what's in blood. So then they say they're growing meat, and it's not meat. It's not any. It has nothing to do with meat. The entire thing is a high-tech boondoggle, and we need to stand against it unequivocally, and we do.
Well, why does it have to be mutually exclusive from the more progressive grazing practices that you espouse? I understand that is your preference, but as long as we have factory farming and hundreds of thousands or millions of cattle being slaughtered in kind of a not mindful way, why can't this kind of be complementary to what you're trying to do in terms of transitioning to a better solution? I mean, we're not going to get rid of factory farms tomorrow, are we?
Well, we need to get rid of them soon. And the problem with Impossible Burger and that whole narrative is that it's just a complete misdirect. It's a intellectual misdirection.
Why can't it be complementary, though? I don't quite understand why it has to be a misdirection. Why can't? I mean, we're not going to get rid of factory farming soon. That's just, there's too much money and too much power in the CAFO system, and you're not going to see beef being produced differently in 2 years on a mass scale. But what if out of Impossible Burger kind of starting to push those guys into the right direction? You don't think they can?
No, from all practical purposes, there's no difference. From our point of view, factory farming and Impossible Burger and Monsanto, it's all the same thing. It's all still the destruction of soil. Remember, we're soil for climate. So we're advocating for soil. You don't improve soil by continuing the industrial soybean monoculture paradigm that Impossible Burger depends on. From our point of view, there's no difference. Impossible Burger may as well be a CAFO.
Because it's built on soy, essentially? I didn't realize that.
Of course, it's still built on soy.
So you didn't really explain that. You conflated Impossible Burgers and veggie burgers, and I don't think most people know that they're the same kind of substrate.
You know, you can grind up sort of peas and beets together, and you can, you know, put some flour and you can fry it and you can call it a veggie burger if you want. But that's not, we're talking about mass industrialization of Impossible Burgers, which is based on the same industrial model of soybeans, which are grown in Utah, what should be tall grass prairie. It should be the best prairie soil in the world, literally in Utah. And for that to happen, that entire system has to go back to grazing with animals.
So hearing news about Burger King introducing Impossible Burger is just this nightmare scenario that you're talking about.
Yes. It's the good scenario should be is, and this is, and I'll work on this, is an executive in Burger King needs to say, you know what we should do? Instead of offering Impossible Burger, why don't we make a commitment to order at least 10% regeneratively produced meats in all of our stores? Bang, there you go. All of a sudden, everybody's switching to holistic planned grazing. All of a sudden, the ecological outcome verification label is showing up all over the place. People are measuring soil carbon. People are asking questions, hello? And now, not only that, but now you have to source it from a million different places. And so you have a distribution of power.
Thus the distraction that you're talking about, huh?
Yeah, you see, so this is an equity issue. It's not just a soil and climate issue, it's an equity issue. The whole thing about Impossible Burger, which is of course funded by Bill Gates, and you know, and then Monsanto is producing all the seeds, and then Burger King is selling. This is all about concentration of power. Concentration of wealth, concentration of power, concentration of intellectual property. So now you're literally eating intellectual property. Think about that. It's exactly the wrong paradigm. What we need instead is for Burger King to say, we're going to be, you know, like I just said, 10%, 5%, 1% for crying out loud, of all our meats are going to be regeneratively produced and verified as being regenerative. Bang. There's your answer. There's your breakthrough. There's your paradigm change. That's what we're advocating for.
If I may add to that, from a climate perspective, we're looking at the need to remove roughly 300 billion tons of carbon from the atmosphere. While it is true that the fake meat burgers have a lower carbon footprint than conventionally grown beef, that's a pretty low bar. The fact is that regeneratively grown grass-fed beef does not have a positive carbon footprint at all. It has a negative carbon footprint, meaning that it is pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. If the goal as our society is to reverse the climate crisis and get the carbon out of the air, the Impossible Burger, Beyond Burger, do not accomplish that goal. They add to the climate crisis.
Have a little bit more than that wiggle in your lingo. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh.
high price bread. Get it now, watch it. Some of y'all hitting me. Shaking on your bones. You got to help on me if you want me to carry you home.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founders of Soil for Climate, Seth Itzkan and Carl Tiedemann. So it's looking like the Democrats are not going to have a climate change debate, but if Soil for Climate were given a chance to craft a question for the candidates, what would it be?
I can't speak for the DNC, but I can speak for some of the candidates or their staffers who we've talked to, and I know that they're very much interested in talking about climate and very much interested in talking about soil. So it's sort of shameful for the DNC to take that position, but the better candidates are not going to be stifled by it.
I would like to ask what the U.S. Department of Agriculture is going to do to eliminate the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and to improve the health of school children throughout the U.S. and to transform agriculture in a way that highlights its role in being the only sector of the economy that can actually reverse the climate crisis. Every sector, transportation, housing, construction, manufacturing, all need to reduce their carbon footprints. That's a no-brainer. But agriculture is the only sector that has that superpower of being able to turn the dial below zero and getting the carbon out of the air. That's a transformation that needs to be accelerated. And so my question to the candidates would be, you know, what are your proposals for accomplishing this?
Good. I like that. Well, I hope that we do have a question like that, even if the debates don't focus solely on climate. Let's hope that Soil for Climate gets enough of the moderator's ears to have a question like that presented.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, I just want to address something I spoke about before. I mean, I know I was kind of animated, if you will. You know, there's a difference between the vegetarian or vegan individual who believes they're doing the right thing by not eating meat, and because they've heard, you know, all the negative stuff about CAFOs and whatever. There's a difference between that and what Impossible Foods is doing. There's just a world of difference. And I fully sympathize and empathize with the sort of the common individual. I was a vegetarian myself for 11 years, by the way. But the Impossible Foods thing is that's just a pure boondoggle. You know, they're just trying to make a lot of money on intellectual property, you know, by capitalizing on misinformation. And so I am upset about that.
Carl Tiedemann and Seth Itzkan, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by John Coltrane, Reverend Horton Heat, and Sir Mac Rice. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.